Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
So today we're doing a deep dive into a truly foundational work, Natsume Soseki's Kokoro. It's, well, less a straightforward story and maybe more like a psychological autopsy, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. It's justifiably a cornerstone of modern Japanese literature. It digs so deep into these themes of guilt, betrayal, and that very modern kind of isolation.
Yeah, the isolation that comes with, as Seki puts it, our own egoistical selves.
Right. And to really get Kokoro, you have to understand the context. Sadiki lived from 1867 to 1916, right smack in the middle of the Meiji era. We're talking about 1868 to 1912, this period of incredibly rapid, almost frantic westernization in Japan.
A huge cultural shift.
Massive.
Yes.
And Soseki, as an intellectual, he's perfectly positioned, kind of caught between traditional Japanese values, you know, duty, community.
And this incoming wave of Western individualism.
Exactly. And his work, especially Kokoro, it really dissects the anxiety and the tension that Collision created.
And the title itself, Kokoro, it's notoriously difficult to pin down in English.
It is. It's often translated as heart or mind, but that doesn't quite capture it, does it?
No, it feels much bigger.
It's more like the spirit, the absolute core of feeling, the essence of what makes someone human. Shiseki uses this one intensely personal tragedy to kind of map the fractured soul of an entire generation caught at this cultural crossroads.
So our mission today, then, is to explore those darker corners of the human spirit that Kokoro brings to light.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, let's get into it. The structure is fascinating because it starts deliberately mysterious. We see everything through the eyes of this unnamed university student, the narrator.
Right, he's young, idealistic. He's basically our way in.
Our proxy.
Yeah, our proxy. And the setup seems simple enough at first. The narrator meets this older man he calls Sensei, which means teacher or master, while on summer holiday in Kamakura.
And he's immediately drawn to Sensei's intelligence, his sort of quiet dignity.
But almost instantly, he senses this deep underlying sadness, this profound melancholy that Sensei carries around.
You see Sensei's life, he's clearly educated, married to this gentlewoman, Shizu, but he lives like a recluse, voluntarily idle, avoids work. Mm-hmm. And the things that really hook you, I think, are those strange habits, like his flat-out refusal to get a job and those monthly visits.
To the grave.
Yeah, the silent trips to some unnamed friend's grave. It's just laid out there as a question mark.
And he doesn't just withdraw quietly. He drops these really heavy, almost philosophical bombs on the narrator.
Right.
Warnings about loneliness being the price of modernity.
Right, the price we have to pay for being born in this modern age, so full of freedom, independence, and our own egoistical selves. That line just hits you.
It really does. And even more chillingly, he says things like, "There is sin in loving." It's like he's putting up these massive walls right from the start.
So the first part of the novel isn't about big events happening. It's all about the narrator trying to figure Sensei out, this mm-hmm. obsession.
Yeah, it's a psychological dig. We, along with the narrator, are asking, what possible tragedy could lead such a seemingly dignified man to live like this?
And you find yourself pulled into the narrator's hero worship, don't you? You want to believe Sensei is fundamentally good, despite all the warning signs.
Absolutely. That desire fuels the first part. Soseki makes us wait, makes us feel that same confusion and suspense that Sensei himself has been living with for years. It's all about this internal burden, this penance.
Okay, so that sets the stage perfectly for the main characters, these, well, tragic figures. Sensei is obviously central.
He's the heart of it, the tragic heart. He is that tormented Meiji intellectual we talked about, defined by this crushing guilt, this self-loathing that's just corrosive.
So his life becomes a kind of
living death, really. He's in suspended animation. It's a long self-imposed sentence for a sin he committed when he was young. He's studying how one moral failing can just paralyze a person's entire existence.
And then the narrator, he starts off representing the hope of the new generation, right?
Yeah, hope, but also maybe the potential pitfalls. He seeks Sensei out as a mentor, full of admiration, but his whole arc is about this brutal emotional education.
Moving from that naive worship to
a really painful disillusionment. Once he learns the truth about Sensei, he inherits this heavy burden of understanding, as the text calls it. It's not a happy ending for his innocence.
And we can't really understand Sensei's situation without the other key figures. His wife, Shizu.
Shizu. She's such a figure of devastating innocence, isn't she?
Completely. She's got this quiet grace. She loves her husband deeply, but she's utterly unaware of the secret, the shadow that lies between them.
She's collateral damage, really. A victim of the choices and the moral failures of the men. Sensei thinks he's protecting her by keeping her ignorant.
But that protection means they can never truly connect. There's no real intimacy possible.
Precisely. And then there's Kay.
The ghost at the feast.
Exactly. He's dead long before the story starts, but he haunts everything.
Yeah.
Kay was Sensei's best friend, but also his rival, his kind of moral opposite, at least initially.
He starts out as this intense ascetic.
Right. Brilliant, but incredibly rigid. Dedicated to truth, rejecting all worldly things, especially love and desire.
Which, of course, makes his fall even more dramatic.
Absolutely. When Kay comes to live with Sensei and meets Shizu, who is called Ojo-san, then his whole worldview just collapses. He falls in love.
And crucially, he confesses this vulnerability, this weakness to Sensei, his trusted friend.
And that confession, that act of trust, that's the pivot point. That's what triggers the betrayal.
This leads us right into Sasaki's structural brilliance, how he tells the story.
Oh, it's masterfully done. He doesn't just lay out the tragedy. He gives it to us twice, almost. First, it's shrouded in mystery. We're piecing things together.
Like a detective story.
Kind of, yeah. And then, bam, the second time, it's a direct, devastating confession. Tragedy laid bare.
So let's walk through that. Part one is the setup, the mystery around Sensei in Tokyo and Kamakura. Part two shifts focus. The narrator gets called back home.
Right. His father is dying. And his father represents that older, traditional, provincial Japan duty, family ties.
Which creates this powerful tension, doesn't it? His sense of duty to his dying father versus this intense, intellectual, almost obsessive connection he feels to Sensei back in Tokyo.
Huge tension. And Suseki paces the climax perfectly. The narrator is anxiously waiting for this letter Sensei promised. The one that will explain everything.
And when it finally arrives, it's this thick, heavy envelope.
And right after it lands, a telegram arrives. Urgent. Suggesting Sensei is gravely ill, perhaps dying.
The implication is immediately clear.
Instantly. The narrator realizes that thick letter isn't just an explanation, it's a final testament. A suicide note, essentially.
And in this incredibly symbolic moment, he chooses. He leaves his father's deathbed, jumps on a train back to Tokyo, and starts reading Sensei's confession right there on the train.
He literally abandons the past, the traditional duty to uncover the secret of this modern, tormented soul. It's a powerful image.
So part three, Sensei and his testament, is just relentless.
It is. It's Sensei's voice, finally unfiltered. He starts by explaining the root of his distrust of people, how his own uncle cheated him out of his inheritance years before.
That early betrayal planted the seed of cynicism.
Deeply. It taught him, or he thought it taught him, that everyone is ultimately driven by selfish egoism, even family.
And that paranoia fuels the main betrayal, the one involving Kay. Both men love Ojo-san. Kay, breaking his ascetic code, confesses his love to Sensei, asks for advice, for help even.
It's Kay's moment of greatest vulnerability. And Sensei, well, he panics. Blinded by jealousy, terrified of losing Ojo-san himself.
He acts with this shocking speed and cunning.
Incredible cunning. Instead of helping his friend, he goes straight to Ojo-san's mother, the landlady, and secures the engagement for himself. Instantly, behind Kay's back.
Completely cutting Kay off before Kay even had a chance to express his own feelings to Ojo-san or her mother.
Exactly. The betrayal is absolute. Sensei reveals the engagement, and Kay, he just can't reconcile it. His ideals, his weakness, the betrayal by his friend. A few days later, he commits suicide.
And Kay's suicide note, while blaming his own weakness, is read by Sensei as a clear indictment.
Unmistakably, Sensei knows deep down that his actions drove Kay to it. He realizes his entire marriage, his future happiness, is built on the destruction of his friend, built on a grave.
Which brings us to Sensei's own final act, explained at the end of the testament.
Yes. He explicitly links his decision to end his life with the end of the Meiji era itself. Emperor Meiji had recently died, and General Nogi had committed ritual suicide junshi following his emperor.
Sensei connects his personal failure to this larger cultural moment.
He does. He says something like the spirit of the Meiji era began with the emperor and ended with him, and that his own life, his own moral consciousness tied to that era, should end with it too. He feels he failed to live up to its highest ideals, the ideals Kei perhaps represented before his fall.
Wow. That connection really elevates it beyond just one man's guilt. It speaks to the themes that make Hokuro so enduring, that idea about loneliness.
That's central, isn't it? Loneliness is the price we have to pay. That line echoes throughout. Sasaki isn't just writing about one sad guy. He's performing this diagnosis on the soul of Japan in 1912.
He's saying this new individualism, this freedom, it came at a cost.
The huge cost, the loss of those shared ethical structures, the traditional bonds. It left people, well, potentially adrift in their own egos, alone.
And you see the contrast starkly with the burden of knowledge theme. Shizu, protected by ignorance, retains a kind of purity, maybe.
A purity, but also a kind of tragic unknowingness. Sensei, on the other hand, is utterly crushed by his self-knowledge, by his guilt.
And the narrator, he gets the knowledge, the truth.
But he loses his peace. He inherits the sorrow, not the serenity of understanding.
And that single act of betrayal against Kei, it becomes Sensei's life sentence.
It's an inescapable prison, as the novel suggests. It shows how unresolved guilt just poisons everything. It corrupts the present, turns love and marriage into a kind of ongoing penance rather than a source of joy.
The image of Sensei visiting Kei's grave every month, it becomes so much clearer by the end.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just remembrance. It's his private ritual of atonement, a self-flagellation that he knows can only really end with his own death.
So the testament, that long letter, what's its ultimate purpose then?
It feels like Sensei's last grasp at meaning, a final desperate act of honesty. He says he wants the narrator to have his story with all its darkness as a reference.
A warning almost.
Yeah, a painful lesson. Maybe to help the next generation, the narrator's generation, navigate the complexities, the darkness within the human heart, within the kokoro, better than he did.
Reading this book, you're left with this really haunting feeling, this gap between how people appear on the outside, dignified, intelligent like Sensei, and the hidden reality, the guilt or sorrow they carry inside.
That chasm is unforgettable. I think the novel's enduring power comes from that brutal honesty. Honesty about the cost of self-awareness and how that tension between, you know, our ethical duties and our own personal egoistical desires. Well, that's still the fight, isn't it?
Yeah.
That defines so much of modern life.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.